The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Well, it's been 10 days and a whole hell of a lot has happened. And who better to help us break it down and understand it than the former host of the nationally syndicated radio show, The Rick Unger Show, as well as Sirius XM's Steele and Unger, my old partner from back in the day. He's a progressive and a conservative's friend. He's been noted in radio and television as someone who's willing to mix it up with anyone with an opposing political point of view. We've had our chance to dance. We're going to dance together one more again as we get into the speakership of Kevin McCarthy, why the hell it took 15 ballots to get there, and the impact this Congress is going to have on 2024. All that and a whole lot more coming up next with my friend Rick Unger. Well, everybody, after 5 days and 15 ballots, Kevin McCarthy is now Speaker of the House after more hype and coverage than was absolutely necessary. And only one Republican dissenter, the famed House rules have been passed. And it's interesting because suddenly after the fact, they found out that there was, dare I say it, a secret addendum that contained concessions, more concessions that Kevin McCarthy had committed to in order to lock in his speakership. There is no one better right now in this moment to unpack all of this than my good friend Rick Unger. You know him, you love him, you followed him. Rick, welcome back to the podcast, my friend.
Always a pleasure. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. And what a new year it has been so far. Because this shit does not get old in this town, that's for sure. Look, let's start with we can go back to next week, but the funny part right now is, I think overarching all of this is still the sort of slimy attributes of the Republican Party. And I say that as a current member of the party.
Gonna say, it's your party, man. I mean,
I don't know what the hell can I do? Yeah, what the hell is my problem at this point? But it is really kind of amazing to me that they just, I mean, this whole idea, oh, let's drain the swamp. Well, they just want to drain the part of the swamp that they don't like so they can refill it with the crap that they got. I mean, it's just... It is just one of those things that your expertise and insights would be welcomed at this time.
What can I say? Look, I mean, this entire adventure all comes down to the ambition of one guy.
Yeah.
Who's been sitting in Congress for a fairly long time now. I'm sure it was always his objective and his dream to be Speaker of the House someday. And, you know, when that is your MO, And let's face it. I mean, Kevin McCarthy has never been a big policy guy.
Right.
He's always been a political guy. That's what he is. Okay. And I'm not casting aspersions for, you know, on that, although I think we'd all like to see our representatives be a little more focused towards policy.
Yeah.
This was the goal. And he was going to do whatever it took to accomplish the goal. And that's what he did. So I don't know why we should be surprised that it turns out there was an addendum to the rules agreement that basically says, oh, wait, there's more.
Right.
You knew there was going to be more.
Well, and that's
going to be more.
That is actually part of the argument that the insurgents, if you will, were making, whether it was Boebert or certainly Matt Gaetz, that they couldn't trust his word. That, you know, they would have a meeting in the room and say he would agree to all this stuff, then he'd go outside the room and say something completely different, which again,
politician.
No, I don't know
no
why
that's intended towards
no,
you.
No, I totally get it.
Politician.
Politician. So I don't know why everybody got so upset with Matt Gaetz when he went on, when he, you know, went out publicly and said, oh yeah, you know, speaker elect McCarthy, I'm all behind him, and then voted against him.
Well, I mean, look, you know, Matt Gaetz is obviously suspect also. There's good reason for a Matt Gaetz not to trust McCarthy. But you know what? There's good reason for all of us not to trust Matt Gaetz.
Right.
Setting aside his rather sordid history, every time he would vote against McCarthy, it would be, you know, in this speakership ordeal, it would be followed within minutes with a fundraising letter.
I got a number of those.
Tons of them.
Yes.
And what was amazing is they were too damn lazy to change the content of the letter.
Didn't have to.
Exact same letter every time.
Well, they didn't have to because they think they know their audience, and they know and what they think they know about that audience. They know that they're going to respond, that they're pushing the right buttons to get them to respond with money as a form of affirmation for the bad behavior that they're currently engaging in. So I want to take a step back because I'd love to get your thoughts as you were watching day one, day three, day five, ballot one, ballot seven, ballot 10. What were you thinking about? What did you conclude even from this process? And what should we take away from it as citizens who, for the first time, actually were kind of forced to pay attention to the election of a speaker and the subsequent rules fight?
It was kind of interesting, actually, because in the beginning, my presumption was that it would end up as it did end up.
Right.
However, there came a time somewhere around, I don't know, sixth, seventh, eighth ballot, where I started to think, you know what, maybe these Freedom Caucus members mean it. And maybe it's not just about, you know, getting an edge. Maybe they are just not going to let Kevin McCarthy be speaker. So I went through a number of ballots thinking, you know, it's going to be somebody else, probably be Steve Scalise. And then as we got to the end, well, we all saw what happened. It kind of reverted back in my mind to what I always thought it would be, that McCarthy would sell his soul to be speaker, and that in fact was what he did. He sold everything. He gave away the store. And then I kind of kept waiting to see if the more, you know, I want to say moderate Republicans, but I think that's really not an adequate description of them. But the more moderate Republicans, I thought there could be blowback there. I thought that maybe there would reach a point where they go, hey, wait, too much. We're going to make a change. But that never happened. So, you know, at the end of the day, it was what I thought it would be, a painful deal with the Freedom Caucus, and a deal that, given what they extracted from him, I mean, I guess you get your bust in the Capitol, even if you've been speaker for a week, you know?
Yeah, I guess.
So I guess McCarthy will get that, but I would.
We may find out.
Yeah, I'll be really shocked if he lasts the whole 2 years.
Oh, I will too. I think that would be, and if he does, God only knows what the Congress will look like.
Yeah.
And where the country could be from a policy wise position.
Well, I'll tell you what it'll look like in 2 years. It'll look very Democratic.
Well, that I think is more and more likely, or at least a case being made for that to be likely. The thing that I found fascinating for me was the right out of the gate, the nomination of Kevin McCarthy by Jim Jordan.
Right.
And then the subsequent nomination of Jim Jordan.
Right.
but what I thought was very interesting was that when we got to the second round, Jim Jordan did not, in his second nomination, tell the Republicans, don't vote for me. I'm not interested in this job. He instead let that nomination stand, and ran through that ballot. And so I just remember tweeting something out about, well, wait a minute. If this is your boy, why are you in competition with him? Number one.
I thought it was a clear message to McCarthy. You know, obviously Jordan had reached an understanding with McCarthy, but he didn't mind McCarthy being reminded that if he didn't hoe the line, that he could run against him.
And that's really the point, because he then comes off the ballot. They make the head fake to Donalds,
right,
to Congressman Donalds, which was an absolute joke and offensive from my perspective.
Well, it was the same thing as why you were the RNC chairman.
Exactly. And right. We'll get into that conversation as our quote friend is having to find his own grace at the moment after groping a young man. But anyway, I digress. But it was interesting to me that he jumps off the ballot, but then has allowed himself to come back on the ballot around mid-range. And I think, to your point, is a reaffirmation that probably based on the conversations behind the scenes getting a little testy, right, and McCarthy kind of throwing down the gauntlet and saying, hell no, I'm not doing that.
And do you doubt for a second that those conversations behind the scenes were being handled by Jim Jordan?
Oh, I do not at all.
It Jim was Jordan, absolutely him.
Look, I think Jim Jordan and Matt Gaetz were the yin and the yang of this process.
Yeah.
I got some heat from some folks on Twitter about, well, why are you praising Matt Gaetz? I'm like, look, I'm not praising him or supporting the process, but game has got to recognize game here.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. He bested the system, as I put it. He punked the hell out of everybody, and there was nothing they could do about it for 15 rounds. But for his own decision to move those last six players into a position to be present instead of actually voting, he could have punked them for a 16th or 17th round.
We'd still be there, yeah.
We would still be there. It's interesting, though, that when we talk about Jim Jordan, and I want to play a quick clip where he was on Fox News talking with Ms. Bream, and she kind of challenged him. It's like, you know, well, you want to be speaker. I mean, you know, not you want to be speaker, but Republicans are now going to be in a position to govern. But, you know, how do you govern? And this is what he had to say.
How do you convince Americans who watch this play out, including this moment, it looked like it could turn into a physical altercation, that Republicans, your party, can now govern?
Well, I mean, Shannon, you just heard from the report that Kevin McCarthy got the same number of votes Speaker Pelosi got last time. She had the same majority number, 222, that we have this time. So sometimes democracy is messy, but I would argue that's exactly how the founders intended it.
You know, that has become such a commonplace bullshit line. That's how
democracy is messy.
That's how the founders intended it. Founders didn't know democracy from a from Mamocracy. They were like, dude, we're just trying to put something together here.
It was messy when they came up with it, but it wasn't on purpose.
Hey, thank you. Thank you. So it begs the question, how do they govern in the face of all of this? We'll get to a little bit of what Speaker McCarthy said about the House and his governance of the House. But there is a broader, more important question of how does the nation stomach or withstand what is about to come? We're already hearing today the aggressive tone that these subcommittees and House committees are going to be taking. Of course, you have the Biden hiccup with now it being right. discovered that his office had at least 10 classified documents in his papers after he was vice president. I'm telling everybody to cool their jets, not the same thing as Trump in Mar-a-Lago saying, not only do I not have it, but you can't have them.
it's not the same thing, but you know what? It's going to cause a problem.
Of course it's going to cause a problem, but that along with other issues, I think become distraction points which get in the way of governing. Because you can, if the GOP could contextualize, you know, a hiccup like this, a political opportunity like this, along with a solid strategy for governing the country, putting forth some policies, pressing the administration by introducing bills that would be tough for them to vote no on, then I'd agree with you on that and go, yeah, this is one of those things that you kind of layer it on. But it becomes Benghazi on steroids,
right?
As I think I've heard you reference before.
That is what the next 2 years are going to be, Benghazi right. on steroids.
How do we unpack that then? What do we do with all of that?
We just live through it. I mean, honestly.
So like a hernia, you just kind of.
It's like a hernia. You grin and bear it, I guess.
Or probably better. Probably gallstones would probably be better because at some point it will pass. But damn.
It's just how it's going to be. I mean, look, you've got a certain reality here in that the Senate is controlled by Democrats. The White House is controlled by Democrats. It's not like the boneheaded legislation.
Right.
That we can expect from the Republicans in the House is going to become law. And they certainly know that. You know, they may be evil, but they're not stupid. So, you know, they're going to spend their time on, as you pointed out, these subcommittees with some pretty strange chairs. And they're going to spend their time doing investigation, Benghazi on steroids. That's what it's going to be. There's not going to be much in the way of legislation. There's going to be fights over important legislation. I mean, getting a budget through is going to be quite the adventure for the next 2 years because that originates in the House. So, you know, it's going to be nothing but fighting. It's not going to be governing.
But McCarthy stands in front of the country and he tells us otherwise. He basically says...
Yeah, but as you just pointed out, McCarthy's famous for going into meetings, saying one thing and then walking out and saying something else. You can never believe McCarthy.
So here's the question. And what do we believe... when he says to us, this.
It's a commitment for an economy that's strong, where you could fill up your tank of gas and feed your family, where paychecks grow and not shrink. It's a commitment for a nation that's safe, where communities are protected, law enforcement is respected, and criminals are prosecuted.
So that's my little testimony to that. What does that mean? What does that mean when you say you're going to make this commitment, but everything the party's doing, everything your committee chairman are starting to lay out, all the noise you're making, when do you make the commitment? I mean, when do you fulfill the commitment?
You don't. I mean, what I hear there is the speech that somebody who was just elected Speaker of the House makes. Doesn't mean it's ever going to happen.
So it's just words.
Well, yeah. But I mean, again, that is the history. I mean, I've been watching Kevin McCarthy for a very long time, and that's what he is. He is a guy who puts his arm around you, says words, and then forgets the minute he walks away from you and runs into the next person who wants to hear different words. I mean, it's just who the guy is.
So we find ourselves at a point, folks, where the reality is you've got a Republican Congress that is fixated on retributive politics, owning the libs, gotcha moments, with you know, the appropriate, to Rick's point, rhetorical niceties and nods to we're going to get something done and these are the things we'd like to do. But I think the broader question then becomes, when you juxtapose that up against a Democratic Senate with Republicans who are going to be in a potential position to take the Senate if the ball starts bouncing a little bit more favorably in their direction.
Which I don't think it will. But yes, they are going to be in a position to do that.
Right. And then a Democratic president.
Yeah,
So you're basically saying the next couple of years is nothing really gets done. There's a whole lot of hot rhetoric and noise.
Right.
And the Democrats are set in a prime position to take advantage of that politically ballot box.
Now, I mean, to be fair, the Democrats have a long history of pulling defeat from the jaws of victory.
Yeah, well, that's good.
So they can screw it up. But apparently my dog has something to say about this, if you can hear him in the background.
No. But he's probably a little bit more clear than McCarthy at this point.
He's probably clearer than me.
You know, I just...
So going back to that point, you know, yeah, I mean, this all really does line up very well, in my view, for the Democrats in 2024, and that includes the White House. It does. I think that you're going to see a lot of Americans turned off by what we're going to see in the House of Representatives over the next 2 years.
So what do Democrats do to turn them on and to keep them turned on in the face of the sort of obstacles that you'll see coming from Republicans, the investigations and all the other noise that happens? Certainly, that, you know, their own little hiccup with Biden's classified documents sort right. of hanging, being held over the head like a sword of Damocles, which, you know, Republicans will milk that for as much as they can. But in the face of all of that, how do Democrats proceed? What does Minority Leader Jeffries do from the House side? Chuck Schumer, who I still don't know if he knows how to be the majority leader in the right. Senate. And Joe Biden, who is a consummate deal maker, but is hobbled by questions of age and capacity and just the general, you know, malaise people have about an administration that keeps him, you know, towing about the 40% mark.
Right. Well, there's a couple of questions there. I think a lot of this will fall on the shoulders of Hakeem Jeffries and the message machine. Democratic message machine, and you know, this goes back to when you and I were doing radio together. It was a problem then for the Democrats, and it hasn't gotten a whole lot better. You know, they've got issues when it comes to messaging. I would really hope that you see less snark coming out of the Democratic leader in the House and more policy. You know, and it's a difficult thing to do because he's going to be on the defensive as a natural default position because right. of all the investigations that'll be coming. The natural tendency, you know, when every time he gets interviewed, the questions are going to be, well, what about what this committee has found and what about what that committee has found? And it's a difficult thing to respond to that in a legitimate way and then turn the conversation to policy. It's hard because if you don't do it just right, it ends up looking like you're trying to avoid dealing with the difficult questions by switching to policy, and then people shut you out. So he's got a tough challenge there. He really does. But a lot of it's going to be on him. Same with the president. I don't think Chuck Schumer is going to play a major role in any of this, by the way.
Interesting.
Because, you know, the Democrats have control of the Senate. They're just basically going to be stopping whatever comes out of the House and complaining when the House stops what comes out of the Senate. So I think that Hakeem Jeffries is going to be the guy. Now, that creates some fantastic opportunity for Hakeem Jeffries.
Right.
If he can manage this well, he could very well be the guy who gets credit for a Democratic victory at all levels in 2024 and create his own trajectory to the presidency in 28.
Well, I agree with that analysis, actually. I think it's spot on a number of levels, particularly with respect to two things. One is the messaging opportunity that's there. And also the second being the sort of personal opportunity for someone like Hakeem, who has been, when you consider others in the House, who has found a trajectory that has allowed him to surpass some of his colleagues who otherwise would be considered more likely to ascend to the position he's in currently. Right. Than he would, given his tenure so far, et cetera, the terms he's had in office. But he is an effective communicator at a certain extent. And certainly we got a flavor of that. And I know it's probably not one of the highlights for you, at least at that time, was his sort of recitation of the alphabet, if you will.
He kind of lost me on that
policy. I do want to play just a little bit of that, because what I found effective about it, Rick, is that it appealed to the average person out there. It's creative, it is appealing, and it does make you think, because you're thinking a little bit ahead in the alphabet and go, so what's going to be P? What's going to be R? But I'll follow up a little bit more. Now, let's take a quick listen to some of what Hakeem Jeffries had to say in ascending the minority leadership position in the House.
We'll always put American values over autocracy, benevolence over bigotry, the Constitution over the cult, democracy over demagogues, economic opportunity over extremism, freedom over fascism, governing over gaslighting, hopefulness over hatred, inclusion over isolation, justice over judicial overreach, knowledge over kangaroo courts, liberty over limitation, maturity over Mar-a-Lago, normalcy over negativity, opportunity over obstruction, people over politics, quality of life issues over QAnon, reason over racism, substance over slander, triumph over tyranny, understanding over ugliness, voting rights over voter suppression, working families over the well-connected, xenial over xenophobia, yes we can over you can't do it, and zealous representation over zero-sum confrontation. We will always do the right thing.
Yeah, that is the alphabet. I know Republicans would have a problem filling in a couple of those letters with words.
Republicans would have a problem knowing the alphabet. But now
we know the alphabet. Even if we use some letters you don't like, but you know, or exclude some letters you don't like, that you do like LGBTQ, but that's another conversation. I thought that's that level of creative messaging for me is something that I'm going to be keeping an eye on over the next 2 years, because one, that's going to eat Kevin McCarthy's lunch every day. Kevin has got nothing that comes close to that. There's no one in the House that could rise to that level. Maybe, and we'll see, like a John James from Michigan, newly elected.
Pretty impressive guy.
very impressive guy, gave a very impressive, you know, vote of support and and endorsement for McCarthy. Donald's may be another one who can, and this is the cynicism that I've seen in the party, where I can see them trying to position the African-American members up against Hakeem rhetorically, because they, the leadership otherwise can't do it. But having said all of that, I still think that he creates a lane for the Democrats to lay out the clarity of their messaging around some of these issues and talk about them in a way that up till now they haven't.
But he's going to have to be clever about that. I got to tell you, if I were advising Hakeem Jeffries, look, the man is going to be in high demand for television interviews. If I were him, I would set the rules ahead of time. First half of the interview, I'm going to answer all your questions about investigations. That's all we're going to talk about. Second half of the interview, it's going to be all policy. And I would require that as a condition. He avoids the problem, because if he starts having to answer questions about investigations and he tries to switch off of it to policy, then he's not going to be perceived as a stand-up guy. He's going to be perceived as a politician trying to slide off the difficult answers. So I would just set it out ahead of time. First half of the interview, ask me anything you want about, you know, the dirt. Second half, though, you have to agree that we're going to talk about policy differences and where I would go if we get control again. I think that puts him in a position to be perceived by the public as a straight up guy, smart, and it might make him president at some point.
Yeah, I think that's right. The problem is going to be that that's not how the Washington Press Corps is going to do it.
I think he can force them to.
Good luck.
Well,
good
if
luck.
They want the interview.
Well, but he, look, first off, most Washington Press Corps folks, unless it's a sit down, aren't going to go to pre-agreed terms. In other words, if you're doing ABC this week, or you're doing Meet the Press, you could probably swing that kind of conversation.
Yeah.
But if I'm dealing with a gaggle, if I'm walking the hall or I'm doing my press conference, that's going to be a tougher sell, and that's where the talent is going to be tested. Because to your point, there are ways in which you can answer those questions and pivot back into your policy. You can go, well, this investigation into Hunter Biden's briefcase or underwear, whatever, you know, brief they want to look at, to me, it's just more mindless idiocy from Republicans. Meanwhile, in our House Economic Committee on, you know, these are the things we're doing. Even Republican members there are focused on the economy or focused on.
But you got to be careful about that. It doesn't appear to be a slide off. And think about the control.
Yeah, but
he
I mean, have. but everybody in the country knows these investigations are bullshit. So what are you sliding?
Well,
what you're trying to walk around the pile of shit in front of you.
That's
everybody gets why you want to do that.
That is true. Yeah, he's not just another interview. He's the Speaker of the House.
Right.
I'm sorry. He's the majority leader.
Right.
He will be Speaker of the House. And even a gaggle, you have control over a gaggle by whose questions you take and whose you don't. I just think that there is a management thing. And I think this is part of the discussion, by the way, when it comes to messaging. Most of these people are crap when it comes to managing it, because they're so hungry to keep getting asked for an interview.
Right. Right, right, yeah. And it becomes this sort of desperation move on everybody's part. The media that wants the interview and the politician who needs the interview.
Right.
a lot of bad things come from that. We're going to take a quick break to get everybody a chance to sort of go grab some more popcorn and get another soft drink. of the adult variety.
He's going to say soft drink. What kind of an audience do you have?
To get themselves ready for the next part of our conversation with my good friend, Rick Unger. We're going to be back with Rick with more discussion right after this.
I know the night is late, but when we come back, our very first bill will repeal the funding for 87,000 new hours. You see, we believe government should be to help you, not go after you.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele, and we are having a great conversation with my buddy, Rick Unger. Rick, as we were heading out to take our break before coming back, we heard the speaker announce that when they got back, the first bill that they want to tackle is 87,000 IRS agents.
By the way, it'll also be the first bill sent to the Senate from the House that the Senate rejects.
Yeah.
But you know what? I mean, it's really a perfect first bill for them. I'm finding this all so irritated because nobody wants to discuss the facts of this. Nobody wants to talk about the fact that over 50% of those IRS agents are designed to replace those who will be leaving over the next 5 years. Nobody wants to talk about the fact that this is over 10 years. This is not happening tomorrow.
Right.
Nobody wants to discuss the fact that overwhelmingly that money is going to be spent not on agents, not on people who will be coming after you for not paying your taxes. Nobody wants to discuss the fact that the entire plan for this is to go after high income people, that it has slid from 16% of all of the audits that were done 10 years ago, right? 16% of them were high net worth people. That's down to 3%. And where does most of our money come from? I mean, this is such a scam on the part of the Republicans. And you've got people sitting there going, yeah, go get them. Why? Because the Republicans are trying to convince them that this is aimed at middle income people. It's not.
It's not. It's not. But that again gets back to the part of our discussion before we went to break around the opportunities of Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer to a lesser extent, and certainly Joe Biden, to frame the argument. The fact that this 87,000 IRS agents piece has been allowed to ferment and, you know, get regurgitated the way it has speaks, I think, to the inability of Democrats to really get ahead of a story when they put something out, or the more importantly, take the story back when someone's trying to run with it in the wrong way.
Excellent point. The Democrats absolutely blew the management of this story. You are right on the money there. And by the way, I left off another fact, and that is if we don't go forward with this, we are going to lose. You're going to add over $100 billion to the deficit. And why is that? Because we're not collecting the money we need to run the country. So, yes, the Democrats, everything that you just heard me say, and all of it can be easily checked out, it's factually accurate. The Democrats could have been out there saying this all along. But yeah. I don't think that they understood it.
Yeah, you know, I think that's fair. And I, you know, just to put it in context, understanding it not in, oh, we don't know what's in the bill or we don't know what it means, but understanding the political implications of having something like that out on the street, particularly when of everything that's in the bill, that's the thing they pull out to talk about.
Right.
And it's
see, the Republicans are still way better at messaging. They always have.
Yeah, we have been. There's no doubt about that. It's part of the bread and butter because it creates the butter to put on the bread. Right.
And it's also easier, I have to say, when you're making up the narrative. it's easier to craft your message. When you have to tell the truth in your message and it's complicated, that's tougher.
Yeah, it is. It is. And it goes to, I think, the larger storylines that we've seen emerge for some time now between the two parties, that the kind of individuals you have who are going to be the point people to effectively communicate these types of messages, the party in power, it's obviously going to be the president, the party out of power. It could be any number of players.
Right.
As long as and the one thing we're good at is constructing the message for every player in the room. So, you know, when we're out of power, we're out of power, you're not going to, you can turn on the Sunday shows and you'll hear the same thing from line to line. That's been a little bit more of a challenge for Democrats over the years. Let's go back a little bit to Matt Gaetz, because I think Gaetz is an interesting figure here, particularly in the governing piece. There are aspects of Matt Gaetz that I think actually wants to create some better bona fides than he has, you know, to sort of elevate the street cred. I mean, I have that sense about him. It's kind of hard though when you've been equated with wanting to go, you know, grapple with 18-year-old girls and
right.
and all of that. And certainly the way you behaved here in the House. But how should we take him and a Jim Jordan, Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Boebert, Gosar, all of these characters, because that's what they really are in the public's mind at this point. They're not considered serious legislators. They're not considered serious people.
Actually, I think Jim Jordan may be taken more seriously. Not by me, but I think by the public.
Yeah, but for what? Name the bill that Jim Jordan has pushed through the Congress.
Yeah, but that's, you're right. But that's not how people see him. What they see is when there is a committee on television and Jim Jordan's being a hard ass.
But that's actually it. You know, when we played the clip of him talking about the governing, you know, democracy is messy. Well, okay, that's a soundbite.
Right.
That's the best you got
and not watching, a very original one at this
right,
point.
Right. After watching what Republicans have done legislatively over the last 7 years.
Yeah.
So what's your take, though, I guess, more collectively? And I'll put a little asterisk next to Jim Jordan for, you know, a whole host of reasons. The fact that the young men out there who suffered. Anyway,
when he was a wrestling coach,
the wrestling storylines around him. What's your take, though, on what this group will look like and how they shape what happens or doesn't happen?
I'm not hopeful that you'll see much change. It's interesting to hear your take on Matt Gaetz. Maybe Matt Gaetz has reached a point in his life where he wants to be taken more seriously. That could be. There's certainly nothing that has prepared me to take him seriously. That could change. But right now, I just see him as a dilettante who likes to make trouble because it gets him publicity and fundraises. I don't know. I mean, look, the Freedom Caucus is no different today than it's been all along. The only difference is they finally hit a circumstance where their clout meant something.
Right.
And it was in this speaker's battle. It's really the first time. You know, the Freedom Caucus has always been on that edge where they have something to say about what happens in Republican politics, and they can be a roadblock, they can be a problem. But it really wasn't until now that they had a real impact. So we may be coming into a new era with them. My bet would be if they are gaining all of this additional power, my bet would be they'll probably screw it up, because most of them, not all of them, but most of them really just aren't very clever.
Right. Right.
You know, MTG, Lorraine Boebert, these are not people that I find to be overwhelmingly clever. By the way, just to, you know, to keep it balanced, I don't find AOC to be overly clever.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's focused on being a rock star. and not a serious, competent legislator. So it's not all on the, right. the Republican side. But I don't think that they're going to be able to rise to the moment of their power. Here they've got it. I think they'll squander it and they'll blow it.
Well, let's listen to Matt Gaetz, who disagrees with you.
Yeah, I'm sure he does.
This is from an interview that he did at Fox News anchor Emmanuel.
You've taken some praise from people who liked the fight that you led this week. You've also taken some criticism. Some people saying this is about fundraising, this is about more media appearances. Do you consider yourself a serious legislator?
Well, absolutely. I mean, one of the reasons we fought for these rules was to ensure that all members of Congress can get involved in the legislative process at a more granular level. For far too many years, under both Republican and Democrat control, power has been centralized in a select few, and that's not good for the Republic. I am not one that's really dearth for a lot of media appearances. I think I'm someone who appears on your network and others more than any other member of Congress. So it's an odd criticism to say that I'm doing this for media hits when I do a lot of those anyway.
Well, he is still doing it for the media hits.
Yeah. But most of what he said there was bullshit. However, he does have a point.
Yeah, he does. And one of the points I think is an example would be in those rules, you know, the fact that it now allowing 3 days right. for a bill to for members to read the bill so that they can actually vote on something that they're familiar with.
And I actually don't think that's enough time.
I don't think not for a 1,000-page bill. No, I agree with that. But it's more than they have right now.
Yes.
For sure.
Yes.
But it's the broader, and it goes, and I'll loop this back to why I made the statement at the beginning of this part of our conversation about Matt Gaetz. Not a fan at all, but I do, in piecing together what I hear about him from people and watching him, I do get this sense that he's now, and I think you kind of alluded to it in with your words, maturing or in the sort of legislative role. And I think this recent fight played a part of that, but also making the case as he did in this clip, you know, what we're doing is for benefits everybody in the House. You know, we're trying to make the House really the people's house, not the Speaker of the House, right?
Right.
The Speaker's house. That has resonance with some Democrats.
It has resonance with me. I happen to agree with that. Look, under both parties, it's long been a situation where the decisions, everything is really done by leadership. And that was certainly the case with Nancy Pelosi at the head of the House. Everybody else has to follow leadership or get in trouble. If they don't do what leadership says, they lose their committee assignments. They get punished for it. And that's, you know, look, we've had the conversation actually about whether or not we'd want to run for Congress. And I've always said no, because I don't want to be somebody with nothing to say and just take orders for 10 years until I reach the level of seniority where I get to give the orders.
Right.
So I think he's actually right on that point. And if that's really something that the rules are going to accomplish, then good. Good.
So let's.
I wonder if it'll actually turn out to be that way.
It won't turn out to be that way. And everybody who's listening at this moment, no, Rick and I have not gone soft or lost our minds. We're back in the reality zone of knowing that everything that Rick just described is that shit ain't happening. So
no.
It's just not happening. So let's broaden the lens out a little bit as we wind up a little our conversation and take a look down the road to 2024. How this Congress starts off, the rules it has in place, a lot of the things that we've talked about, all of these are going to be pebbles and in some cases potentially boulders that a presidential nominee for the Republican Party will have to contend with. An incoming president who may seek re-election certainly will have to contend with. How does all of this begin to play out for the prospects of presidential candidates, whomever they may be? I don't think our nominee will be Donald Trump. I really never have.
I agree.
And I'm not even convinced that it'll be the governor of Florida. I think it's going to be a little bit more fluid than people may realize. But whomever it is, how does this Congress impact how they start their presidential run?
A lot of it's going to depend where the country is at as we get into the season. If we are still in this period of, oh, you're a Republican, I hate you. Oh, you're a Democrat, well, you're evil. Then it kind of directs how this all sets out for the Republican candidate. I think what's going to be very interesting, this next presidential election is going to be all about Joe Biden. And I got to say, I am somebody who thinks that Joe Biden has done a very good job in the main. He's gotten through important legislation. And all of that said, I don't think he should run again.
Mm-hmm.
I think the intangibles are a real legitimate issue. His age is a real issue. Maybe it shouldn't be, but you know what? Unfortunately, it is. His gaffes. You know, when he was younger and he made gaffes, it was like, oh, that's just Joe Biden. Now there's another explanation for it,
mm-hmm.
which may not be real. It may not
or
be
fair.
Or fair.
Right.
Nevertheless, when you're his age and you make those kinds of gaffes, people's minds are going to turn towards mental competency. I think that it's a dangerous person for us to nominate. So I think that's going to have a lot to do with it. You know, whether he does, he's acting like he's going to run again. I think that's a mistake. I hope he's acting that way just so he doesn't become a lame.
So who do you line up in his stead? The vice president is certainly going to be on the
vice president would get her ass kicked by any Republican out there.
But who's going to take on the vice president in a primary?
Pete Buttigieg. You think that's still a problem?
Oh, that's yes. Lord have mercy, Jesus.
It could be. It could be. But
I mean,
you know
Pete's
what?
A buddy of mine, but it's not Michael still speaking. Is the country's already?
No, I understand.
The country's very clear about a lot of things. And,
well, we thought they were very clear when Barack Obama ran for president.
No, that's different.
You think so?
Oh, it's very different. It's very.
I'm
different.
Not sure. I absolutely accept that you could very well be right.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. And if it's not him, I'm not sure who that Democrat is. I'm really not.
Well, there's the governor of Michigan. There's the
Our bench is
governor of Virginia. I mean, he's a Republican. I mean, the governor of Pennsylvania, yeah. Who I don't think makes that leap after 2 years in office.
No,
but
I don't either.
Names, you know, like, you know, Shapiro-like candidates are there. And that really speaks to the broader problem.
Let me ask you this, though. You make the point about Pete Buttigieg's problems.
Right.
Is Shapiro, that name, a problem? Is
no.
the country ready to elect a Jewish president?
Probably.
Think?
Yeah.
Because I'm not sure.
I don't think it's weighed the same way
right.
for a lot of reasons. I think Pete Buttigieg's problems are not just the gay family situation, which I think can be dealt with. It's South Carolina black voters aren't voting for him.
If South Carolina black voters aren't voting for you, you are not going to be president.
And that's part of the challenge, I think, in the main is, you know, how does he turn around his record when he was mayor with black voters?
Right.
That's business left unfinished for a lot
you
of
think
those
that's
voters.
The bigger problem.
I think, yeah, since Democrats are reorienting the opening salvo of their primaries and South right. Carolina is going to play a prominent role.
Key. Yeah. No, that's very
yeah,
fair. Very
of course.
Fair.
Of course. It does change dynamically, which I think, again, all of these things lead to the conclusion that Joe Biden will likely be the nominee for good, bad, or whatever.
Can he win?
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes.
You don't think the country is that concerned about the ageism?
I don't. I think it's great for folks on my side to make fun of, but then we've got 40-year-olds who act like 10-year-olds. So true.
I hope we're not that much
better off.
I hope you're right, because I have to agree with you. I think he probably will be the nominee. Yeah. I think he wants to be. I worry about him winning. And again, that's against the backdrop where I think he's been a very effective president.
I think the move for Joe Biden is to run, win, and after 18 months, step down. So his vice presidential pick will be huge.
Yeah, and it won't be the same one.
It won't be the same one.
No.
It'll be huge. Then you look for Hakeem Jeffries being lifted up out of the House and onto the ticket.
Could be.
All right. So now that we've solved that problem.
I like your thinking on this. That's an interesting scenario. The fly I see in the ointment, I don't think he steps down after 18 months.
That's a good fly. I mean, it's got wings, it's got wings. So it's avoiding my swatter so far, but that's okay. I still got range.
I like, if you were a Democratic strategist, which I continue to maintain you should be, if you were a Democratic strategist, that would be a great plan.
Yeah.
If you can get him to go along with it.
If you can get him to go along. Look, your vice president, you'll serve 6 years. Your president, you will serve 6 years. You've left the country far better off than it would have been otherwise.
Agreed.
You've, in my view, would have been the president that I said he would be, and that is a transitional president.
Right.
You did a little bit of Roosevelt, and that felt good, but that was not your mission.
No, that's right. Right?
And so you've completed that mission. We've made the generational change in the House. Now it's time to make the generational change here. And
you've got to be thinking this through now. Can Hakeem Jeffries jump to that role after not even having been the speaker, just being the majority leader?
Probably not. But I'm just saying he's sort of a placeholder for that generation. I think if anything, look, if I'm doing this seriously, I pull Governor Whitmer out of Michigan and bring her on the ticket. And then boom, you've got your first female president.
Interesting.
But, what do I know? Just how to win elections and strategize. Rick Unger, he's my main man. Like I said, folks, there's nobody else I want to have this conversation with, because he gets it and he understands it and he can relay it back to us in a way that makes it make sense, as he did in our time together. Rick, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure for me.
As we head out the door, folks, I'm going to leave you with a couple of things. One, do the voodoo you do so well. I love it when you do that. Check us out on Twitter at Michael Steele, the podcast at Steele_podcast. Follow Rick Unger, please, on Twitter at Rick Unger. Certainly watch for him from time to time. You still doing a little radio here and there? And
I still do a little here and there. I still do a little TV here and there. Mostly I'm retired, though.
You mostly retired. There's nothing retiring about Rick Unger, that's for sure. All right, folks. God bless everybody. Thanks for taking a little bit of time with us. And on our way out the door, I'm going to leave you with the words of our new speaker, who has an invitation that we all should take advantage of. Until next time, be safe and be well.
My friends, this chamber is now fully open for all Americans to visit. I want to give all Americans a personal invitation. You are welcome to see this body at work. No longer will the doors be closed, but the debates will be open for you to witness what happens in the People's House.
Retaliation with Julie Roginski is a weekly podcast focused on the stories of women who have spoken truth to power and have persevered despite the costs. It shares the experiences of courageous people who have sometimes been celebrated, but too often castigated for standing up for themselves and for others. Each week, I examine the structures, systems, and culprits responsible for perpetuating and promoting workplace toxicity. You'll hear stories from female celebrities, music label executives, politicians, police officers, and many others as we examine the cultural reevaluations, policy changes, and legal steps that can finally bring an end to the ongoing attack on women in this country and around the world. Listen on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.